Welcome to the Athenaeum Review, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Michael Zoni, Director of the Fairbank Center for Chinese Studies and Frank Wensheng Wu Memorial Professor of Chinese History at Harvard University, and the author of many important books and articles, including most recently, The Art of Being Governed, Everyday Politics in Late Imperial China, as well as editor of A Companion to Chinese History and co-editor of The China Questions, Critical Insights on a Rising Power. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
So in your new book, The Art of Being Governed, you explain how certain families and households, in this case along the South China coast, beginning in the late 14th century under the Ming, had to deal with their obligation to provide one soldier on active duty in the army at all times in perpetuity. And you show how the need to meet this obligation created a variety of social forms among what eventually might become large extended families, basically to decide who would have to go serve and what this man or his family might get in return. So could you start by telling us a little bit about how you came to write this book and sort of what you discovered as you were working on it?
Sure, that's a great summary. you've clearly read it very carefully. So the project was actually born a long time ago when I was writing my very first book, which was in turn a drive for my doctoral dissertation. That became a book called Practicing Kinship, which came out about 15 years ago. And that book was based largely on lineage genealogies. So these are records that families in China have kept, going back in some cases many centuries, recording lines of descent, but also often recording other details that are relevant to the affairs of the family. And the my first book, Practicing Kinship, was about trying to trace the origin of the organized extended family in China. When I talk to my students, especially my students of Chinese descent, I often hear, oh, family is very important in China, right, or very important in Chinese culture. And this has always been a question that I've wanted to interrogate. Do Chinese people have a special gene for family? Do Chinese people who have never read the foundational texts, right, emphasizing the importance of filial piety and so on, why do they value family? So it's not so much that I was questioning the notion that Chinese people value family, but I was trying to understand it historically, right, and understanding where it came from. So in the course of that book, as I said, I was reading a lot of genealogies, and I noticed that the genealogies of people who had played a particular role in Ming government were distinctive. They had distinctive stories. They had very extensive accounts in some cases of how they related to the Ming state, to the Chinese state in Ming times. And these families were precisely these military households that you've mentioned, people who had a hereditary obligation to supply labor to the state. What the founder of the Ming, Zhu Yuanzhang, the Honghu Emperor, who reigned from 1368 to 1398, had in mind when he set up this system was basically a self-sufficient army that would always provide its own replacement labor. By making families responsible in perpetuity for providing a soldier, he thought basically he could spare his government the problem of conscription and the draft. Just as one soldier passed away, he'd be replaced by his son. The problem was that the social reality became much more complicated. Some families had lots of sons, some families had no sons, and the Ming structure left it up to these families to decide how to fulfill their obligation. And so the genealogies basically tell the stories of how families dealt with what was fundamentally a tax obligation. And it's a really cool thing, actually, to read about how I mean, we all have our strategies for how we juggle our taxes and the worries that beset us that we might not be telling the IRS the exact, even not necessarily deliberately, right, but that this is a stressful thing for us today. And all we have to do is pay money. We don't have to go off and serve. It's really, really cool to read these stories of people 500 years ago dealing with very similar challenges. And that is kind of the larger intellectual question that the book is about. When we think about how people in pre-modern times relate to the state, it's all too easy to fall into a kind of simple binary. Either people do what they're told or they resist.
Right.
And intellectually, the book was all about kind of complicating that binary and showing that the reality historically is much more complex, and also to bring to the fore and to draw attention to the tremendous complexity and sophistication of the kinds of strategies that ordinary people developed to deal with the state.
Yeah. You know, just as a side note, when you mentioned your students today, as an American, it's amazing to me to think, is this right that these lineages that go back, you know, to the time of say Joan of Arc or something like that, that people who are there right now can look back at their family that goes back six or seven centuries. It's really remarkable.
Well, many of these genealogies actually go back millennia.
Okay.
and one of the challenges for me is figuring out when these genealogies become reliable.
Right.
And I actually think they tend to become reliable right around this point, right around the 14th century, precisely because they're not just legends of who our ancestors were.
Right.
They're actually tax documents.
Right, right.
But it is truly amazing. And one of the wonderful things about this project, and one of the things that makes me really love being a historian, is these genealogies, of course, exist in libraries and they exist in archives, but the vast majority of them are still in the countryside in China.
Yeah.
And the only way to get them is to go there and talk to people. And one of my favorite things as a scholar is talking to people, mostly older people, because younger people are not so interested in this stuff, and these old men in rural China can talk about their ancestors in the 15th century, the way we talk maybe about our uncles and our grandparents, as if they're living presences.
Wow.
It's extraordinary.
it's really amazing. To maybe follow up about this question of research method, which I found completely fascinating, which your research methods, that is, which involves this kind of field work, including visiting temples, observing religious ceremonies, and as you said, talking to people and so forth. I was curious about how you mentioned how, because of this nature of the interaction between the state and the people, that there are these kind of negotiations that take place. And so on occasion, at least, some families or some people have incentive to sort of even make things up or kind of, you know, change the record. And I was curious about how you evaluate these sources and kind of how you decide what is trustworthy and what is not trustworthy as you're looking back.
That's a great and very challenging question.
Yeah.
We live in a postmodern age, and so the question of what is trustworthy is kind of different than it would have been a couple of hundred years ago, right?
Right.
So for me, I'm very rarely interested in, you know, whether a given text records something that is historically true or historically accurate. What is interesting to me is, so I begin with the assumption that people write things down for a reason.
Right.
And so what I want to know is, why did they write these things down in this way at this time?
Yeah.
What kinds of interests are being served by the creation of these texts?
Yeah.
That being said, I think one of the, it's not really the focus of the book, but one of the really, I think, kind of interesting discoveries or observations in the book has to do with relating the official record to the private record.
Right.
So the Ming veritable records, which are the records that were kept by the court scribes of what was going on in Beijing, in the capital, and were kept very meticulously. They were political documents. We can't just assume they were true.
Yeah.
But they talk about a military transfer that took place in the 1380s or the 1390s, basically a bunch of people from one part of China were moved to another part of China, and the people from that other part of China were moved to the first place. And if you go to these communities today and read the genealogies or even talk to people about their ancestry, they will say, oh, in 1400, we used to live there and we came here. And it matches perfectly.
Yeah.
Now, there are multiple reasons for why that might be, right? It might be that they read the court records.
Right. I think
that's pretty unlikely. But the matching up of these records is really interesting. Wow. And if I could just tell you one more story
on this subject,
because it's not in the book, but I was in rural Sichuan this year, and we were looking for the site of a great battle that had led to the extermination of what we would now call a minority people, the Boer people. There are no Boer people anymore. They were wiped out by the Ming in the 16th century. And to find the battle, we needed basically local people to help us.
Right.
And we found this one old guy, and he was very, very helpful and warm. And, of course, he was very old, but was still much better at climbing the mountain and slashing through the jungle than we were.
Yeah.
But I said to him, are you from around here? And he said, no, I'm not from around here. I'm from Jiangsu. I'm from coastal China.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, so when did you come to when did you come here? And he said, oh, in the 1560s.
Wow.
And I think it probably is. But so it comes back to your point about verifiability.
Yeah.
It is true that in the 1560s, a bunch of soldiers were transferred from the coast to this part of Sichuan, which is in inland China, to eradicate the Boer people.
Right.
There was a military campaign. What I think probably happened is that once the Boer were declared eradicated, it was very uncomfortable to be a Boer person.
So
a lot of the sort of stragglers and remnants of this exterminated people said, oh, we're part of the campaign.
Right.
So the interesting thing here is not whether this guy and his family really were soldiers from Jiangsu. The interesting thing is that at some point in the last five centuries, it became politically productive to trace this route of ancestry.
Wow.
And that has left a legacy that shapes the identity of people even today.
Wow. I guess another follow-up kind of dealing with both the way that people have moved or been moved, and then also the existence of these categories and identities today, and thinking about some of what's been in the news here lately. I was curious whether, when you talk to people today, is there much interest in these kind of consumer DNA testing, like 23andMe, where in David Reich's book about ancient DNA, there's this idea that if you get a test, you can have kind of some evidence about where your ancestors came from. But it sounds like maybe the people here wouldn't really need that, since they've already got there.
They already know exactly where they came from. That's a really interesting question. I don't think 23andMe is big yet in China.
Right.
And I think there are probably some strong reasons why it won't be big. There's a place in northwestern China in Shanxi province called Hongdong County, and something like some enormous percentage of the Chinese population in North China claim that they originated from Hongdong County, a totally unrealistic percentage. And my colleague and my friend Zhao Shuyu, who's a professor at Peking University, has come up with a theory that the Ming succeeded in the 1360s, the Yuan Mongol dynasty, and brought to an end centuries of foreign invasions of China. Hongdongxian was a place where refugees from the Mongols were basically, so it was a refugee camp.
Yeah.
And Zhao Shuyu has come up with this really interesting idea that there must have been a huge amount of genetic mixing, which I mean, that's a polite way of saying lots of the nomadic invaders must have raped lots of local women. Local women probably, in many cases, made decisions to marry men from the invading groups.
Yeah.
And after the return to a kind of nativist tradition, this became shameful and embarrassing.
Yeah.
Everyone
yeah.
wanted to be authentically Chinese, and so they invented the story of being refugees who had passed through this place.
Yeah.
Your question brings to my mind the fact that this theory could now be tested.
Right.
But probably people don't want to know the answer.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Wow. Going on a bit with the military households, I wanted to ask you also kind of over the long term how the system worked. So just for context for sure. People listening, I understand the Ming Dynasty began in the late 14th century, and at one point there may have been as many as 2 million soldiers in the army. But then I also understand that military service was not necessarily prestigious or coveted and might even be seen as something to be avoided. And so eventually the emperors needed to hire more and more mercenaries because they had problems filling the ranks. And so my question would be, if you could talk about how the institution of this conscription system originally gained its legitimacy, and then eventually why it later ran into problems.
Right. Okay. Well, I've never really thought about the legitimacy of the institution. Uh-huh. Right. In the sense that pre-modern state institutions don't need to be legitimate, right? I have to think some more about whether it was legitimate in the sense that it was the emperor had decreed
right. But then there were problems.
Although I talked about the Ming a moment ago as a kind of return, to a nativist tradition.
Right.
In fact, this idea of hereditary occupational status actually came directly from the Mongols.
Oh. And
they never admitted this, but they were really copying the invaders.
Okay.
And it had to do also with the founding emperor of Ming's vision of a stable society.
Right.
He wanted everyone to just be happy with their lot. And so military service, in a sense, was simply a particular form of tax obligation.
Right.
There were craftsmen and artisans, and it was their job to produce things that the government needed.
Yeah.
There were farmers, and it was their job to produce crop to grow grain that would be paid as tax. And there were the soldiers, and it was their job to serve. But the reality is, people don't necessarily want to do the job. They don't want to do the job the government tells them to, and they certainly don't want to do. Lots of people listening to this have this experience. They don't want to do the job their fathers did or their mothers did. Right. So there's kind of natural resistance to this. There's also the reality that this was a system that required a lot of monitoring for it to work.
Right.
You needed documents saying, you need to monitor the soldiers in the places where they came from. You needed to move them from their home, from where they were born, to where you wanted them to serve. If they died while on while serving, you had to go back and find someone else. So it was a very, I wouldn't say inefficient. It was probably an inefficient system.
Right.
The main thrust of the book, as I said, is to think about the different strategies that people came up with to deal with their obligation.
Right.
But I don't talk about, in part because if you use my methods, it's really hard to. I don't talk about all the people who said,
right,
to heck with this,
and
took off.
Right.
And this is happening in part because the Ming is becoming a more prosperous economy. There are a lot more opportunities to make money.
Right.
Ming would have been one of, if not the richest economies in the world in the late 16th century. This is happening, so there are a lot of people saying to heck with this and taking off.
Right.
At the same time as the threats on the border are growing in the north, and the Manchus, who will later become the Qing Dynasty when they successfully invade China in 1644, are becoming a more and more serious threat. And so the state has no choice but to hire mercenaries. Mercenaries has a kind of negative connotation in English, but really just means a paid army.
Yeah.
Right? It was supposed to be an army of people who had this ready occupation, and increasingly they need to pay their soldiers. And there is an argument that that the cost of hiring all these soldiers basically bankrupts the Ming. And so this major turning point in world history with profound implications is actually the result of a fiscal crisis caused by these military households that I'm talking about. And just to give one indication for why this is such a turning point in human history, in world history, is that the Ming state is a big state. It's like 8 times the size of France, but it's maybe a third or a quarter of the size of China today. And vast parts of China today, including the northeast, including Manchuria, including Tibet, and including Xinjiang, so much in the news at this point, these are conquered by the Qing. The Ming had no interest in these territories.
Right.
And so the Qing conquest. And so, if you could say that the strategies that I talk, I mean, this is not the argument I'm trying to make, but you could say that the strategies that that I'm talking about in this book have pretty enormous consequences. They lead to the fiscal collapse of the Ming, which leads to the Qing invasion, which leads to the Manchus being in Beijing, which leads to the expansion of China to its current borders. So small things in history can have big consequences.
Wow, that's, yeah, no kidding. So, yeah, if I want also to maybe ask about some of these kind of bigger picture questions. I guess, well, actually, since you were just talking about the Ming and the Qing and the question of the borders, I thought I might jump ahead and ask how these periods are commonly seen by people in China today. For example, I think you might have alluded to the Ming period being a kind of smaller territory, but maybe more along the lines of a kind of national identity, whereas the Qing having expanded to be more of a kind of multinational empire, and it strikes me that people might prefer one or the other model as they're thinking about what China is today, and the kind of taking one or another up as an example. So just in a general way, if you could talk about how people might be in the public might be citing the Ming or the Qing today as kind of
interesting.
Historical.
Well, so history is, I was going to say that history is really important in China today, but then I think about Hamilton,
right?
And it's not like history is not important in America.
Yeah.
And of course, one of the reasons Hamilton has struck the chord it has is not because there's all of a sudden this sudden interest in this one guy. It's because it's somehow, however remarkable he may have been, but it's because it speaks to contemporary issues and contemporary concerns and contemporary questions. And I think in that sense, China is very similar.
Right.
There's a lot more history in China,
yeah.
And so there are a lot more resources that you can use to reflect on and talk about contemporary questions. There's also, although the growth of the internet has had the same kind of consequences for the entertainment industry in China as it has for here, there are still blockbuster history shows that everyone watches.
Yeah.
And one thing I find really interesting is to try to figure out why this emperor all of a sudden catches a chord. And I'll mention two examples. One is the sort of height of the Qing in the late 17th to the 18th century. This is the golden age of the Qing, three long-lived emperors who preside over a very stable period, a very prosperous time before the Western impact is starting to weaken China. And it's pretty clear that when China under the Qing really is the largest empire in the world.
Right.
And it's fairly clear that that speaks to people's concerns now about global tension,
about trying
to find a place in the world. At the same time, there was a few years ago a real interest in the Ming.
Yeah.
And some people talked about a Ming fever.
Yeah.
And I think the Chinese people today also see parallels with the Ming in their own lives. The founding emperor, as I've hinted earlier, was very ambitious.
Right.
Basically, had a plan for society.
Yeah.
And but it didn't work. People didn't want to do what they were told. People wanted to move around. People wanted to buy things. People wanted to be prosperous. And of course, Chinese people today see that parallel.
Yeah.
So the Ming lasted 270 something years.
Yeah.
The Ming still works. If you follow the Ming model, China still has a good 200 years. But to come back to your initial question, I think people prefer one or the other at different times and in different contexts. So yes, China is the early modern empires. China is the only one that retains its old boundaries.
Yeah.
And that is a source of enormous problems for China, enormous tension for China, but also a source of enormous pride for the Chinese people. So, no Chinese person would ever accept, very few Chinese people would ever accept the position that it would just be easier if these territories were allowed to secede, were allowed to go off and do their own thing.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of ambivalent tension between empire and mono-ethnic nation state,
right.
that actually has interesting parallels to our own society. And one thing, there's as you probably know, there's a lot of concern right now in the media, but among scholars and also among governments about the human rights crisis that's unfolding in Xinjiang. One of the Chinese responses, not formally, but one of the Chinese responses I've been hearing from interlocutors in China is basically this is our version of your Native American problem.
And
they probably in some ways rather not have that problem. It's a problem they have to deal
with. Fascinating. I wanted to ask maybe just a couple more questions about kind of your work. And you've talked a little bit about your research methods already, and they sound so fascinating and really kind of fun to me, this idea of kind of field work where you go and you meet people and you talk to them and so forth. And I wondered if you could just say a little bit more about kind of how you came to this research method and how it's how it's developed.
Sure. Well, I came to it through extraordinary good fortune.
Yeah.
I was incredibly lucky to have a series of teachers. My doctoral supervisor, David Four, at Oxford, and then my kind of Chinese mentor, Professor Zheng Zhenman of Xiamen University. Since the beginning of opening up and reform in the early 1980s, they and some other people associated with, who are now associated with a school we call the School of Historical Anthropology, started thinking that there's this extraordinary revival of tradition in China going on. Excuse me, after the Cultural Revolution, as temples are being revived, as ancestral halls are being rebuilt, and it's really our last chance to see a world that is disappearing. And so they began in the 80s, and then I followed them in the 90s to basically wander around villages, looking at the material culture, gathering texts, doing oral history. It was a lot harder in those days, if for no other reason, because there was no transport infrastructure. So it used to take us, hours and days on buses to do what now we hop on a motorcycle and take care of. And of course, there are all kinds of stories about the difficulties of living conditions in those points. But I think what I learned from those teachers and what's continued to shape my own work is that there are all kinds of ways in which history leaves traces in contemporary society. It leaves material traces. I've talked about the temples and the ancestral halls.
Yeah.
It leaves textual traces. It also leaves some of the most interesting traces it leaves are what we might call ritual traces or religious traces. When after an interruption of 30, 40 years, people began to revive their festivals, their religious festivals in the Chinese countryside, they were very anxious to revive them accurately and correctly, because they wanted to be faithful to tradition, but also because these are rituals that are very meaningful to them. A ritual, if you're doing a ritual to protect your community from illness, you better do it right. One of the things that I noticed, or that we noticed, was that there were a lot of debates about who should be allowed to participate and who shouldn't be allowed to participate. And because these were debates about recreating the ritual, what they were actually what we could see them as is debates about the scope and size and rules of the community. So if you go to a temple and you see that this part of the village worships and that part of the village doesn't worship, with care, you can actually understand that as indicating that there was some kind of divide in the community in 1948 or whenever the last time it was held. And so you can actually, even by looking at who comes to a ritual in 2018, you can learn something about how community was defined much earlier. And these traces of how the community was defined, what was important, what were the narratives, the stories that were told, they're sedimented, and you can find sometimes layer upon layer upon layer. And if you unpack each layer, then you actually have a whole history of how even a tiny village in rural China has defined itself.
Yeah.
So it's, and of course it's, there's a certain urgency to this work because without exception, these villages are being plowed over and turned into condos or in some cases turned into tourist, tourist, like Disneyland sort of villages, which to me is actually sometimes almost worse because it makes it even less. I suppose the reason for me it's almost worse is that then there are these weird narratives that are introduced of what people think tourists want to hear.
Yeah.
And that makes my job much harder. But the idea that you can triangulate between oral history, what you see in the village, and then texts that are the kind of more normal texts that historians use, texts from the archives. That's really what I've tried to develop over my career. And in fact, my most recent book but one, which came out about 10 years ago, actually tries to take those methods and apply them to the 20th century. Okay. And I'm actually pretty happy with how that worked out.
Oh, good. Well, and for the record, which is the title of that book?
So that's called Cold War Island, which is the amazing story of life on Kamoi, which is a little island in the Taiwan Straits that was one of the most militarized places in the world in the 1950s and 60s. In fact, there were two times where the U.S. literally considered the use of nuclear weapons against China to defend this little island. That book kind of makes me regret a little bit my life choices because I basically that was my book that I had to write to get tenure. So I had to write it in a certain style. It's an amazingly romantic story, but I had to kind of strip all of that out. I wish it was a more accessible book. It's still a pretty scholarly book.
Wow. Okay. Great. Finally, I understand that you're currently working on a book project on village China, where you look at 20th century history from the point of view of the villages. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that project and what we can look forward to.
Sure. Well, the basic impulse behind the book is that I've spent a lot of time in rural China over the last 30 years.
Yeah.
But never really thought about pulling all of that work together.
Yeah.
It's also driven by kind of stage in life, where you want to tackle a bigger topic, and in a way that's more accessible. And it occurred to me that when I teach survey courses in modern Chinese history and in the history of China, and it occurred to me that even though until quite recently, rural China, village China, was where the vast majority of Chinese people lived. The countryside and the experience of living in the countryside figures very little in our textbooks. Textbooks are mostly about Mao Zedong and great leaders, and about the life and experience of the cities. So the book is basically trying to, or the book will try to tell, it's not written yet, will try to tell the story of modern China from the perspective of the countryside. I think it's gonna do a couple of things. One is I think it's going to try to situate Chinese history better in a different way in world history. There's a real way in which around the world the story of the 20th century has been a story of urbanization.
Yeah.
Around the world, most people 100 years ago lived in villages in the countryside and. By the end of the 21st century, most people will live in, and barring some unexpected developments in Africa and in India, most people will live in cities. And so the Chinese story then becomes part of world history, but with some peculiar inflections.
Right.
Chinese people after 1949 were not allowed to move freely to the cities.
Right.
They were only allowed to move in certain regulated ways under communist orders. One thing that means is that Chinese cities... very unusually in the developing world, don't have slums, right? So we can actually see we can situate this story of urbanization in a world context. The other thing I want to really argue in the book or show in the book is how the big history, the decisions that are made in world capitals and by world leaders like Mao Zedong or like Deng Xiaoping, are experienced differently by rural people.
Yeah.
And also, the third point and the last point is that rural people actually don't just do what they're told.
Yeah.
they interpret these this big history. They interpret these decisions. They negotiate it. They manipulate the rules to make their best opportunities. And so, if we really want to understand why the course that China has taken over the last century, it's not really a matter of just saying was it top-down decisions or bottom-up movements, but it's the interaction of the two. So I'm hoping that will be the story of this book.
That's the everyday politics that you're
talking about. So I'm taking everyday politics in the Ming in my old book and moving it back to the 20th century in the book I'm working on now.
Fantastic. Very, very exciting. Thank you. Our guest today is Michael Zoni, author of The Art of Being Governed, Everyday Politics in Late Imperial China, out now from Princeton University Press. His visit to UT Dallas was made possible by the Anlin Ku Lecture Series at the School of Arts and Humanities. And this is the Athenaeum Review podcast. Andrew Oh is our engineer, and we're produced by Creative Disturbance. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.